Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Amitava Kumar's second novel, Immigrant Montana, is a literary immigrant tale with a provocative modern edge, one that fuses story and reportage, anecdote and annotation, and picture and text. The result is a moving novel that explores cultural misunderstanding and is an impassioned investigation of love. Kumar was born in India, is an immigrant, and recently wrote the New Yorker piece, Being an Indian in Trump's America. He's also the Helen Lockwood Professor of English at Vassar College. The new novel is Immigrant Montana. It is a great pleasure to welcome Amitava Kumar to this week's book show. Always nice to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
At what point did this idea of being an immigrant and what you personally went through, did you say, I would like to explore this in my fiction?
You know, very early, I wanted to record what was happening to me. What were the new sights? Simple things. You know, for example, till I came to this country, I had never eaten yogurt which had fruit in it, right? So right. I wanted to just note it. And I would do that in writing maybe a letter to my parents. To think of that as a fictional undertaking, though, that took a longer time. And maybe 5-7 years after I had been here, on a train, I wrote what became the opening scene of this novel. A simple line, you know, something about the monkeys would leave the branches of the tamarind tree and peel the oranges left unattended on Lotan Mamaji's balcony. Cool? One little scene.
Beautiful.
But then decades would pass before this became a book. Other books came in between.
You talk about those things that come to you, and I assume they come throughout the novel that you insert them, but there's one part of In America, Land of the Free, Home of the Brave, it was possible, figuratively speaking, to discuss genitalia in public.
Yes. But that is based partly on this memory of hearing Dr. Ruth, who's wonderful.
Oh.
That was a revelation to me, you know, the discussion of sex in this particular way.
Well, listening to her when I was 13, that was a revelation.
good. See, we share things across cultural boundaries. And then, but then I thought for my narrator, just having this experience of the Clinton-Lewinsky affair so that the discussion becomes a public thing. And of course, it has taken a much more perverse turn in recent times with our current head of state. But that too was a surprise for me.
Right.
You know, the idea of a president engaging in a sexual act, et cetera, you know? So,
let us set the scene for a moment and have you read from the beginning of the novel. This is
sure.
Immigrant Montana, and this is the first part of the book.
I was a new immigrant, eager to shine, and if self-abuse were to be omitted from the reckoning, pure of body and heart. The letters I sent my parents in India were full of enthusiasm for the marvels of my new life. To those who welcomed me to America, I wanted to say, without even being asked, that E.T. ought to have won the Oscar over Gandhi. I had found the latter insufficiently authentic, but more crucially, I felt insufficiently authentic myself. Not so much fake as insubstantial. I understood that I needed a suitable narrative to present to the people I was meeting. There was only contempt in my heart for my fellow Indian students who repeated stories about trying to educate ignorant Americans in barber shops who had asked how come they spoke such good English, or if they belonged to tribes, or if they grew among tigers. The nostalgia I had come to treasure was a hypertrophied sense of the past as a place. A place with street signs and a figure atop a staircase that I recognized. This desire had nothing to do with the kinds of claims to civilizational superiority that make men demolish places of worship or want to bomb cities into oblivion. I knew this, and yet I was uncertain about my story. I lacked calm self-knowledge. If a woman spoke to me, but particularly if she was attractive, I grew excited and talked too much. I'm talking of what happened more than 2 decades ago. My first years here and my first loves. But the reality of my becoming who I am now, this evolution, as it were, goes back to the time, to the monkeys that surrounded me as an infant. This is my own personal origin of species. The red-bottomed monkeys of my childhood would leave the branches of the big tamarind tree and peel the oranges left unattended on the balcony of Lotan Mamaji's house. This was in Ara, in eastern India, in the late 60s. A war with Pakistan was over, and another loomed in the future. Prime Minister Nehru had been dead only a few years. In the language of the history books, the nation was in turmoil.
Amitava Kumar reading from the new novel Immigrant Montana. It's published by Knopf. We all hear about the American dream of coming to this country. Do you feel that there is a preparation for what you just described in this, in the first section of the book, that all of the things that you kind of dream about then become overshadowed by the insecurities? Do you ever think of the insecurities going into the situation?
Yeah, I think I was always marked by a certain degree of insecurity, but I was always, always seduced by the dream. So in other words, the insecurity came out in the form of thinking I would be turned back at any particular time. I'd received the visa,
right,
which seemed an impossibility, but then I did. And even when that happened, even when checking in, I thought someone would say, you know what, I don't think you're a good enough student. You should have gotten straight A's. Or when I landed, I would think they would send me back on some. You know, that fear was always there. So that is the insecurity,
right,
that has, to some degree, after all these years, never really left me.
A feeling that you explore in this book through a story of an immigrant, through a love story, through just trying to work through what should be very simple things, which is basically getting from point A to point B, putting one shoe in front of the other. And that can be hard.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what is also great is that you're trying to do this simple thing, but there are always so many other examples that are so dazzling to you that can serve as inspiration. One of the people I talk about in this book is this gentleman who was not born too far from my own village. But he comes here decades before I did to Princeton,
mm-hmm,
goes to Tunisia to do, in his real life, I've given him a fictional name, but he goes to Tunisia to do his PhD, gets involved in the Algerian struggle. Then he comes back to this country. Vietnam War is going on. He falls in with the Catholic brothers, the Berrigan brothers, to protest the Vietnam War and is indicted for conspiring to kidnap Kissinger. Now, this kind of identity, which is not a narrow national identity, but one that is, you know, belongs to different nations almost and is in deep solidarity with the people, the ordinary people of the country he has come to. That was a great inspiration. So in other words, even while I was thinking about going from point A to point B, I was aware how other people, in going from point A to point B, had with a degree of great agility jumped through points D and point F while landing at point B. You know, a kind of a cosmopolitanism that is enviable.
And I assume you figured out very early on that it was more than luck.
Yes, yes. It was also a letting go of nostalgia of a particular kind. It was certainly letting go of a narrow nationalism of a particular kind. It was also learning, you know. I was very fortunate. I'm among those people who come from abroad on a student visa. They have been offered a scholarship, and they have been offered a teaching assistantship, for example. And they study here, and they learn. I mean, I learned a lot, you know. It was a real education for me. And for a while, I thought I would go home. But then I thought, no, this was my home. A long time had passed. Yes, I thought learning and a deep exploration of the central issues of our time, more than luck, meant finding a sense of identity.
Let us talk about your main character, who has several names throughout the novel, and which is a story in of itself. I'll begin by calling him AK. Tell me about the different variations of his name and how you came to that.
Yes, that's a good question. What happened was, I would play around with different Indian names because I did, of course, want him to have an Indian name. And I thought, as a provincial, I'm a provincial. You know, I'm from the most backward part of India. So I thought his name should be a little bit more traditional name. So his name is Kailash, which is the name, actually, of the mountain on which Lord Shiva lives. Fine. In the Himalayas. Mm-hmm. So Kailash. And then I thought, playing around with it while writing my book, I thought, what would they call him here? And for some reason, Kalashnikov came to mind. And then I thought, okay, that's AK-47, which happens to be my own initials.
Right.
AK. And I thought that would be, even if you'll allow me to say so, I thought that was clever. You know, I thought, okay, there is the possibility of playing around a little bit. Someone might think, is that his identity? Is he being autobiographical?
Yeah.
And therefore I could mess with the idea of fiction and fact a little bit, which I think is a part of the novelist's privilege.
Well, you were clever throughout this novel. I mean,
You're very sweet. Thank you, John.
They're very distinct moments of that cleverness on display. And how you employ it is fascinating because there are these little snippets. There are pieces from, I mean, it's an artistic book
Thank you.
What you have included with pictures and text and clippings and so forth. So you're playing around a lot.
Yeah. What happened over all these years, when I was working on other books, is that I maintained these notebooks. So, for example, I came across a mention in a magazine of all the reasons, 235, 57, I can't remember, that people had given about why they have sex. It included anything from, I wanted a turn in the conversation, to, I wanted to burn calories. And I found that funny or interesting or intriguing. And I noted that down. So in that same way, all kinds of other things about animals or about places, or I would write little scenes, and it just existed there in the notebook. And so I could finally, when I got down during a residency at Yado, I began to think about pulling it together. I could go back to something that had just been stored in these notebooks for so long. I could sort of arrange them in a way that I thought would engage and entertain readers.
You considered the history of pleasure?
Because, you know, I do think...
To be the title of the book.
Yes, I thought, or at least I say, the narrator says that.
Yes.
Because Philip Roth, I mean, in some ways, this novel, from the point go, I thought should be about bodies or about people exploring pleasure. And Philip Roth is someone who has been a master at that. And so I thought of paying tribute to him in a footnote by saying, I considered this title. So that was one thing. Except my narrator somewhat self-deprecatingly says that he wasn't ever as artistic, if not on the page, then at least in bed, as many of Roth's narrators. So then it goes into another stream.
Which is beautiful. Just out of curiosity, was that before he passed?
Yes, it was before he passed. I don't think there have been many days I have not thought about him since then. You know, I've just finished reading this novel by Lisa Halliday, called Asymmetry. She was the one who had a relationship recently with him before his death. And you can hear his voice in it. It's amazing just to do that, you know.
There are moments where AK also tells us about his mentor.
Yes.
About who has helped him.
That's right.
Get through and grow.
That's right.
Which I assume is also a reflection of what you had.
Yeah. I had good teachers, and I could see how good teachers influence young people. And now I'm a teacher, whether good or bad remains to be explored. But so, you know, that figure has loomed in my mind, both as a professional engagement and also as my past. The person who I drew upon was this legendary figure who is not very well known, certainly not in India where he's from, but he was here in New York. Then he taught at Hampshire College. Edward Said, dedicated culture and imperialism to him. He was a friend of Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn. And when he died, Kofi Annan delivered the first memorial lecture in his honor. This man's name was Iqbal Ahmed. I never met him, but thinking of my own teachers, I kept thinking how my narrator, with his messy love life, and with the lives of the others around him, which were messy too, because people are young and they're innocent, how would they interact with someone who was so idealistic or political or compassionate? And so I've put that in the center, thinking that my book would have a moral center if there was someone like that in there.
That moral center is often the character talking to himself, right? Of having these conversations.
Yes.
And then feeling as if he's being judged by those conversations.
Yes. You know, whenever I'm speeding on the highway, as I was a little while ago while coming to you.
You made it on time, so good for you.
There's this internal dialogue that happens, that what will happen when a cop stops me, you know? And then it has been such a constant feeling, that one, that I then generalized from that and thought of, how do I turn the feeling of being an immigrant or being an outsider or feeling judged into something where you're always speaking to that cop, except I elevated him and made him a judge. And the judge never speaks, but he's there all the time. And my narrator, therefore, is always in that court. Mm-hmm. He's not always, but often is. He is trying in these little soliloquies to justify what he was doing or to explain what he was doing. I just thought it would be a different register to explore motivation or something.
I assume that could be a cop in life. That could be a parent. That could be a spouse. That could be a god.
Yes. Sure. Why did I choose a judge? Maybe because the immigrant always thinks of the immigrant judge one day, you know. One day having to justify that. I don't know.
Well, which brings us to the point of, given what we are living through now,
right?
You have an immigrant story that happens and happened regardless of the election results of 2016. But to write about it and to tell the story and for readers to accept and understand what you're saying and to consider what you're saying, it comes at an interesting time.
Yes.
Do you take that into account in writing it?
I'd done most of the work before the rise of the current president. But I've thought about it ever since. And I've thought whether it was, you know, the immigrant's appeal to his humanity in this book is couched in a language that certainly for Mr. Trump would be very provocative, because it doesn't say, look, I'm coming here to increase industry. Look, I'm coming here bringing my wealth or my intelligence. It says, I'm coming here and want to share with you my desire, you know, which is a very provocative point to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a president who has said all Mexicans are rapists. So to say, consider me human because I love one of your citizens, is a rather provocative claim, I think, in the current juncture. People wanting to come here, those who are being separated from their children, are making the argument in terms of survival that I need to be able to live, to escape what I'm escaping from. Consider me human. Allow me in. I'm not making that claim. And yet, of course, I would like to make that claim. Or you understand through the exploration of the immigrant condition or the pasts in this book, other people's pasts in this book, that those are the conditions people are fleeing from. And so that question that is in my mind, which I don't make in the book so much, but I think about every day now, is, you know, the last century was the immigrant century, and now it will be more like the century of refugees. The way the global warming is happening, the way things are shifting elsewhere, borders, people can strengthen them, but nothing will keep the flux of human flow stemmed or stopped for too long, because crises will only deepen, especially with the kinds of policies we have in place. And so we'll have to change our attitudes towards immigration. We'll have to change attitudes towards the rest of the world.
There were so many of us who, during the campaign season, when Donald Trump, the candidate, walked out and said, I am proposing a Muslim ban.
Yes.
And use those words, Muslim ban.
Yeah.
That many of us thought, well, okay, there goes the election. I mean, that did it. He's done now. That's it toast. The fact that it's accepted, mm-hmm. one. Two, that he was elected. Three, in a much more watered-down fashion, has been confirmed by a Supreme Court. How does that make you feel?
I feel the short-sightedness of such policies is damning not for others so much as for ourselves. And the simple reason for that is that in the long run, precisely the people we marginalize or set outside the pale are the ones who are going to be all the more anti-American. So forget, oh, we have to uphold democracy here. What I feel most concerned about is that in order to keep a certain sort of humanity alive, we are more and more urgently need to recognize the humanity of others and not tar everyone with the same brush. Also, I think it's a part of the story we are telling. People are coming here not simply because they want to come and work in the fields in LA, but they're coming here because the governments we have replaced in Central America have taken a human toll. The policies that we have followed in relation to the global climate has also led to flooding in Central America. We have been at the heart of altering the ozone layer in a way that, you know, developing countries don't alter, and therefore they are also, with rising water levels and changing climate conditions, having to flee their homelands. So it's not just about the Muslim ban. The way we have conceived of the global other populations all has to be not only fundamentally rethought, but I think under the Trump administration, we have veered away from our common humanity.
There's a point where the character wonders if there's anything here for him. That's a crisis.
Yes, it is. He experiences, he's looking at the mirror and he thinks he doesn't have a place to stand. That happens early on. And I have felt that then. I felt it later on. Not because of any shortcomings of the culture or people here. Mm-hmm. People have often been very nice and the culture has been very giving. I have benefited enormously from studying here and teaching here. But simply because you are torn between contrary desires. You think, what can I contribute there? And you also think, do I ever belong here? I mean, you know, not to be narcissistic here, but, you know, I have often entered a room, opened a door in a strange place and asked myself if others are asking, who is he? What is he doing here? You know, so that sort of thing, where you do not naturally belong. That feeling has also not left me. So it's a part of a crisis, which is fine, you know, keeps you unstable and alert.
But there's insecurities in all of us that I think has many of us wondering when we walk into a room of feeling like you belong or feeling that you're not, you know, at some point they're going to ask for the keys and tell you to get out.
Very good. Yeah.
So that in some way is universal, but that feeling, especially given the climate we're in now, it seems that feeling that there's nothing here for you can only be exacerbated by a culture that in however small the percentage seems to agree with that.
Even as you were saying that, first of all, let me address the first part where you said that we all share in some way some insecurity. I just want you to say, yes, yes. And therefore, let's take a moment to applaud those who have the courage to use the sense of their belonging to stage a protest, who do not question their belonging. In fact, they assert their voice. I mean, someone kneeling when the national anthem plays.
Right.
Would I dare to? But someone else who says, I belong here and I will do this, that just amazes me. My daughter in her class wrote for Veterans Day an essay about how she admired that these veterans had protected our freedoms so that other people could protest in these ways. And I thought, wow, her articulation has come from a place where she has a true sense of belonging. And I was really proud of that. Mm. I don't have it. Now, I've forgotten the second part. What you had taken it.
Yes, it's a small population. The percentage is small.
Yes.
But the feeling is there that has to some way creep its way into those insecurities.
What I want to advocate on that question really is that people, if they understand how interconnected our worlds are, that we should think that we are at home nowhere, all of us. And therefore we are all citizens of the world. And therefore we are responsible to each other and we think about each other. And we behave in ways that accord respect to each other, that would make of us proper citizens of this planet, which is endangered. You know, that's where I want to take the sense of belonging and unbelonging.
The novel is beautiful. It's inventive. It's fun. It's Immigrant Montana. It is published by Knauf. Amitava Kumar, what a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.